right, we're continuing now in our study of the book of 2 Kings, as we have started that book. So in our study of these books, what we refer to as the books of history, as they typically we divide the Old Testament up as far as categories are concerned. We usually look at the first five books of the Bible, those ones that God inspired through Moses, that at least contain the law in parts of four of them, but Genesis through Deuteronomy, they really are alike in many ways in the material. Of course, Genesis is very much a book that describes the beginnings of all things, but from Exodus through, well, really starting in Genesis, as we learn about Abraham and then Isaac and Jacob and God's promises to them, as we see that brought to fulfillment in Exodus and through those books when God gave the law to Israel through Moses and gave birth to them as a nation. And then we get to Joshua when they enter the land of Canaan. And from Joshua through Judges and those books covering the period of the judges on into 1 Samuel, and then we have 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, and 1 and 2 Chronicles. We refer to these books as books of history, and really Ezra and Nehemiah go in that category too. Of course, they're not just history books. They do record the history of Israel through the judges and the kings, but they are books of examples, really, and teaching us about God and his judgments and his ways, and using those examples, good and bad, to instruct us. So through this part, we have now gone through Joshua, Judges, and we have looked at 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 Chronicles and 1 Kings. And we're well into 2 Chronicles, but now we've started 2 Kings. So we, from that standpoint, we have basically a book and a half to go of the ones dealing with the kings until Ezra and Nehemiah, which will really look at the period after the captivity, from the Babylonian captivity and afterwards. But starting 2 Kings now, we're at this point where we're looking at after Ahab's death, and just once more, we mentioned that 2 Kings, as with 1 Kings, has the primary subject matter of the kings of the northern kingdom of Israel. At least that is until we get to chapter 17, which is where that northern kingdom comes to an end. So here, for the first 17 chapters of 2 Kings, the primary focus is going to be on those northern kings, the kings of Israel that ruled over the 10 tribes. The book of 2 Chronicles focuses primarily on the southern kingdom, the kings of Judah, which Benjamin was following them. Of course, once we get to chapter 17 with the end of the northern kingdom, after that, all you have is the kings of Judah. So 2 Kings from chapter 18 to the end of the book is going to follow 2 Chronicles very closely. But so right now here, as we look at 2 Kings, we're back to focusing on the kings of Israel. We've already taken the opportunity to go through the reign of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, whose reign overlapped mostly with Ahab, the most wicked king that Israel had. Well, he died in the last chapter of 1 Kings, and his son Ahaziah became king after him. Jehoshaphat is still king of Judah during his brief reign, which lasted for about one calendar year, 2 years by the method in which they counted. That was that information is contained there in those among those last verses in 1 Kings in chapter 22, in verse 51 specifically is where he mentions the length of Ahaziah's reign. So he had a very brief reign, much like the reign. Well, really, it's not just much like; it's exactly like in terms of how long he reigned with Jeroboam's son and then Baasha's son, and both of those houses were utterly destroyed as God had foretold, and he had promised that he was going to bring utter destruction on the house of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, for all of his sins that he committed and made Israel to sin. And he fulfilled that, used Baasha to do it as the instrument to destroy Jeroboam. But of course, Baasha then walked in the same ways of Jeroboam, and God said he was going to do to him exactly what he did to Jeroboam and his family, which after Baasha died and his son reigned for a year, that's exactly what happened. So, and we're going to have the third case of this now, because God promised utter destruction on the house of Ahab like he had done to Jeroboam and Baasha. And so in a similar fashion, where the leaders of those families, Jeroboam, Baasha, and now Ahab, died, and then their sons took over, and in all three cases, their sons ruled for a year. Now, one difference here is that Ahab's going to have a second son that's going to reign, and then it's the destruction is going to come in his time. So that's where we'll have a little bit of a deviation from that pattern, but it's going to end in the utter destruction of the house of Ahab, as God foretold through, especially through Elijah the prophet. And we're reading much about him in this first chapter of 2 Kings also. We've gone down through the first 8 verses just to summarize briefly. When Ahaziah became king, and he was a wicked one, it told us in verse 52 of 1 Kings 22, so really just a couple of verses before we start 2 Kings, it speaks of Ahaziah and says he did evil in the sight of the Lord and walked in the way of his father and in the way of his mother and in the way of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. So there's where he is compared to three of the most wicked people that we read about in all the Bible, Ahab, Jezebel, and Jeroboam. So he walked in the ways of those three. So that puts him in really the worst of company that you could be in, spiritually speaking. So God is not going to have much to work with Ahaziah himself. And he's not going to obviously see any purpose to keep him on the earth very long. So chapter 1 here of 2 Kings gives us the circumstances concerning how he's going to leave this earth. The first verse tells us about Moab's rebellion against Israel after Ahab died. This goes along with the pattern, as God had promised, if they did not keep his commandments, their enemies were going to come against them. They would lose their territory. They would flee before their enemies. And that started under Ahab because of his wickedness. And I mean, that's how Ahab died, when he was trying to forcibly take Ramoth and Gilead back from the Syrians, who had taken that. Well, the Syrians had taken that because God had given it to them to punish Ahab and Israel for all of that wickedness. And that's why Ahab failed in his efforts to recover that city. And God had foretold that when he went to do it, he was going to die in that battle. And he did. Ahaziah continues that wickedness, as we see, and so the enemies are encroaching more upon their territory. Now it's not just the Syrians, but here Moab now rebels against them. But then the next thing there in verse 2, we read about Ahaziah having what we would refer to just the way the particular word that we use in English for circumstances like this, that he had an accident. Now, when we read God's word, is there really a such thing as an accident? No, that's a word that we use. There's some words that we throw around there that if we're speaking with understanding from what we know from what God teaches us, there's really no such thing as an accident per se. Now, are there categories of events with some that involve the intent of people versus some things that happen that is not by intent from any other person? Yes, and I mean, I know we use the word accident that way too, but no, I mean, it does. There's no indication here that Ahaziah intentionally jumped off of through that lattice and had his fall, or that anybody pushed him or something like that. But it's not an accident from the standpoint, it was not just some random thing. that just happened. God's working in all things. Did God intend to take the life of Ahaziah? He did. And this God was the one at work here. So this was from the hand of God. No question about that. So God's the one that gave him his life, and God was the one that was going to take it, and this was the manner in which the Lord chose to do that. So Ahaziah had this fall. Now, is it possible that had Ahaziah responded differently, if after he fell and had these severe injuries where it was very questionable in his own mind about whether he was going to survive or not, had he taken that opportunity to consider his life and that he was essentially a breath from eternity, and taken thought of himself, examined himself, and then turned to his Maker, might this have had a different outcome? Well, that's entirely possible. But did God know the heart of this man? He surely did. Did he have a choice? Of course, Ahaziah had a choice here. But he chose in keeping with the heart that he's describing there, that are among the most wicked people that we read in God's Word. So when he has this fall and he has these injuries, and I know I'm maybe being a little nitpicky when I speak about words like when we talk about an accident, but we do need to think about that. And do we use the word luck? Do we talk about being lucky, and do we believe in that? I mean, those kinds of words that really, it bespeaks that God is not the one really active or involved, doesn't it? As Christians, I mean, do we read the word luck or lucky in the Bible? We don't, and there's a reason we don't. So if things happen that turn out very well for us in some way, do we say, well, we're lucky? In fact, how would God think about that if we're attributing it to something that's inanimate, something that is just random, and not giving him credit? If something good happens to us, where did it come from? I mean, where does every good and every perfect gift come from? So there's, of course, that's on the good side. And on the bad side, this wasn't bad luck for Ahaziah. This happened for a reason, and God was behind it. And so here he fell down there and through that lattice in his upper chamber that was in Samaria, there in his palace. He was sick, and this is obviously from those injuries. How did he respond to that? Did he think, my father died last year, and now I might die. And what of my soul? All that I have, I'm about to leave. What have I done with my life? What should I do? Who put me here? And instead of thinking those thoughts, and which could lead him to turning to God and repenting, now later on and. We'll have an example when we get to the latter part of 2 Kings and also in 2 Chronicles. We can look at what happened with Manasseh, and we start to read about his reign. I mean, it would be very difficult to make a case that Manasseh was, with all the things that he did, that he didn't belong in the same category with Ahab and these others he's talking about here, and Ahaziah. And looking at it the things that he did, if I'd been in that time, well, even when I read it now, it's very unusual to see somebody that evil to make such a repentance like he did. But he did, God worked with him. So there was one, and God delivered him into bondage and chains in Babylon, and then he turned to the Lord when that happened. After he ignored many prophets and did very evil things, filled Jerusalem with the blood of the innocent children in their idol worship. So he had brought Judah down to a very low point, horrible things that he did, but he repented. So it's not that that choice wasn't there, that opportunity for Ahaziah, but he didn't do it. In fact, he added sin to sin in this case. So when he was with these injuries and he was uncertain about whether he would live or die, and he wanted to know whether he would survive this. So he's obviously very doubtful about it, but instead of saying, well, bring one of the Lord's prophets here and inquire whether I will live or die. No, he sent his messengers to inquire of Beelzebub, the god of Ekron, whether he was going to recover of his disease, it said in verse 2. And then God spoke to Elijah the prophet and told him to go meet Ahaziah's messengers and ask, is it because there's not a god in Israel that you're going to Ekron? That was a city of the Philistines. So here Ahaziah, king over 10 of the tribes of Israel, wearing the name of their father, who was the grandson of Isaac and grandson of Abraham, the one that God made all those promises to, the God of heaven, and that he made the covenant with, and he gave them that law. So that was a God-given name to Israel. They were identified as God's people, and he doesn't even believe that Israel has a God. By his action, that's a statement that there's no God in Israel if you're going to send your messengers to another country to ask of their God, so-called. But that's what he does, and that's why God says that not because there is not a God in Israel that you go to inquire Beelzebub, the God of Ekron. And then he said, thus saith the Lord, thou shalt not come down from that bed on which thou art gone up, but will surely die. And then Elijah delivered that message to Ahaziah's messengers as they were en route to Ekron. And they turned right around and went back to the king to report that message that they were given from Elijah. And so when they said that, they gave the exact account word by word of what Elijah said to Ahaziah when they returned there to him. And so Ahaziah asked them in verse 7, what manner of man was he which came up to meet you and told you these words? And they answered him, he was a hairy man and girt with a girdle of leather about his loins. And he said, it is Elijah the Tishbite. So obviously from that description of his physical appearance and his manner of dress, that identified him as being Elijah the prophet. So Ahaziah knows who it was that God delivered that message through. Was he wanting to know that? Who was this so I can send these words of thanks to that he saved you from that long journey all the way over to Ekron and was able to give the answer that I needed and bring it immediately like that? So how can I thank him? And that's not why he wanted to know who it was. Why was he so determined to find out exactly who it was that gave that message? He wanted him dead. He wanted to have him killed for those words. Now, were these Elijah's words? Of course not. These were God's words, thus saith the Lord. Obviously, Ahaziah would not be able to kill God. God was going to take care of Ahaziah. But what was he going to do then? Well, kill the one that he spoke through. At least that was his mind to do so, clearly, because of what happens next. So when he identifies the one that spoke the words, and if he were just to stop there and consider, well, what has Elijah's record been so far? I mean, would Ahaziah, he's obviously not ignorant of who Elijah is. How could he be? I mean, what kind of role did Elijah have with his own parents in what had been happening through those years, really through what would have been Ahaziah's entire life, what had been going on there that involved Elijah? I mean, was Ahaziah around during the time of the famine? Well, he would have almost certainly, but if he would have known about that 3.5-year famine that goes back to the book of 2 Kings and 1 Kings in chapter 16, when Ahab became king then, and then in chapter 17 it told us about the famine that occurred in Israel, and Elijah had prayed for that. So Ahab blamed Elijah for the famine. And Elijah was having to hide for his own life. How did that famine come to an end in 1 Kings 18? That's when God sent the fire down from the sky. Ahab was there and was there for that miracle, because when he met Elijah, he called him Israel's enemy. And Elijah told him, "It's not me, it's you. And for what you have done, it was Ahab." The famine was not Elijah's fault, it was Ahab's fault. I mean, God was the one that made the famine happen. If Elijah had asked for that famine and he was asking unjustly, I mean, if Israel had been seeking God and he just asked God to bring a famine on Israel, would God have heard that and done it? Of course not. But that was in keeping with God's will and what he had promised that he would do. Famine, defeated by their enemies, those were among the curses that God promised if they did not continue to obey the Lord, and they obviously were not under Ahab, so that's what happened. But then God sent that fire down from the sky to consume the sacrifice and on the altar to Jehovah that Elijah had. Ahab's prophets of Baal failed in their efforts to do so. So by a miracle, God proved on that day to all Israel who God was and who his true prophet was. So as far as the credentials were concerned, as far as the evidence for Elijah being a true prophet of God, was there any question about that? Jan, I think this may have gone, something happened here. This was something as far as Elijah being proven to be a prophet of the Lord. He was. Just pause there for a moment.
What did it do? There. Sorry.
Check it. All right. So, obviously, Ahaziah has heard of Elijah. He would know all of this. Did I do something, or did it just, was it okay all along?
It's okay.
Okay. Well, I'll just ignore it then. no problem there with, I thought we had lost connection there, but we had not. Sorry about that. So it's not a question of whether Elijah had been proven to be God's prophet or not. He had been, but Ahaziah didn't believe. And then Elijah, of course, had foretold exactly what was going to happen to his father and where the dogs licking up his blood and the place where they had licked up the blood of Naboth when Ahab and Jezebel had taken his vineyard. So that came to pass precisely. So how much evidence was there that Elijah, he raised the dead there in Zarephath of that widow woman? And I mean, God had borne witness to Elijah through those miracles. He'd fulfilled all the prophecies that he had made. So how could Ahaziah question whether Elijah was speaking God's word rather than his own? But he didn't believe anyway. What about his parents? So he's just carrying that on, as it had said there in verse 52 of 1 Kings 22. He walked in those ways of his parents and Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. I mean, he didn't. None of them believe the prophets of the Lord, and he doesn't either. So he wants to kill the Lord's prophet. Well, did Ahab want to kill Elijah? Did Jezebel want to kill Elijah? And they failed to do it, but he obviously thinks he's going to... Well, if he fails, it's not going to be for lack of trying here. And that's what happens next. So let's read verses 9 and 10. So after he said, "It is Elijah the Tishbite," in verse 8, "Then the king sent unto him a captain of 50 with his 50. And he went up to him, and behold, he sat on the top of a hill, and he spake unto him, 'Thou man of God, the king hath said, come down.' And Elijah answered and said to the captain of 50, 'If I be a man of God, then let fire come down from heaven and consume thee and thy 50. And there came down fire from heaven and consumed him and his 50. So, I mean, here's this old man sitting on a hilltop, why does Ahaziah have to send 50 soldiers with a captain to go get this old guy? I mean, there's a, does he have some thought that, well, Elijah's not just a typical man? I mean, obviously he knows about the history, but instead of, this is really along the lines of, is there really any difference between this and what Jeroboam did when he sent his wife in disguise to go to God's prophet to find out what was going to happen to their son and whether he was going to live or die? I mean, he had known that man was a prophet, so how is going in disguise going to, how is that going to help with a prophet? And then Ahab, what he did when he went in disguise into the battle, when Micaiah had said what was going to happen there, and Elijah had already foretold his death, how is going in disguise in that battle going to spare him? So, I mean, there it shows on the one hand, they recognize this is not just a man speaking their own words, but there's no real faith there to be so foolish as to try to use a disguise to get around it, because that's really saying they think they can disguise themselves from God, the one who was bearing witness to them with the miracles and all those fulfilled prophecies, and that was not going to succeed, and it didn't. But now, how is a disguise going to trick God? No. If Elijah has the power of God, which he did, how many soldiers would it take to get him down from that hilltop? I mean, he sent 50. He obviously thought, well, there's 50 is going to be enough. You get a captain with 50 soldiers, and they're going to be able to take this old man. But it's not this captain of 50 soldiers against an old man on a hilltop. This is a captain with 50 soldiers trying to oppose whom? God. And so how many soldiers would it take to be able to overpower God? I mean, this is so foolish when you look at what he was actually doing. And but that's clearly what he's thinking. I mean, he didn't send one soldier because, I mean, he obviously thought he had some recognition that Elijah's got some power on his side, and it's the power of God. But how's any number of soldiers going to help in that case? Well, here's the answer. And Ahaziah is going to have that answer. And is this going to be when this captain and 50 soldiers get burned up by fire? Is he going to say, oops, I mean, that was very foolish? No, he's going to do it again. He's going to send another captain with his 50. Now, not only is Ahaziah being foolish here, well, even with the first captain of 50, do you think that they had heard of Elijah? Who hadn't heard of Elijah in Israel? I mean, at this point, who in Israel would have not have known who Elijah the prophet was? I mean, all Israel had been gathered together to Mount Carmel back there in 1 Kings 18. That was something for the entire nation. Everybody knew who Elijah was. So with that going on, even though Ahaziah doesn't believe, I mean, does that excuse the captain and his 50? When Ahaziah told that first captain and his 50 soldiers, go get Elijah, if they had any faith at all, any fear of the Lord, what would they have said to that? No, I'm not going to do that. Or if they went, obeyed the king, they would go like the third captain finally does, with some humility. But here he marches up to Elijah and says, the king says, come down. Well, who is Ahaziah to God? And he refers to him, obviously, having heard of him and who he was. He says, you man of God. What does that term mean? It doesn't just mean a godly man. That's a designation for a prophet. We saw that back in 1 Kings 17 with that widow woman from Zarephath. That was the term that she used for him, knowing that he was speaking God's word when she raised her son from the dead. And that is a specific term for a prophet of the Lord, and that's what he means. And that's why Elijah said, if I be a man of God, if I am a prophet, so why is he calling him a prophet and thinking that he could forcibly take him to Ahaziah? And this was going to be not for Elijah's good. This is with ill intent. I mean, this is going to result in Elijah's death, no question about it. But why would this captain refer to him as a prophet of the Lord and think that he could come and force him down there too? So this is not just foolishness on Ahaziah's part, but also on these soldiers. But this having happened, what about the second captain that goes? Knowing what just happened to the first one, how foolish is he to go and to say the same words, which is exactly what happens, verses 11 and 12. But then you can also think with when the first 50 and their captain got burned up, why does Ahaziah think that sending another is going to bring Elijah there? So there's so much foolishness going on with these unbelievers. Would we refer to that as a strong delusion? When somebody has that will not glorify God as God, and they've been given a strong delusion that they might believe a lie, and those are the words from 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verses 10 through 12 when he's describing that. But, I mean, this is obviously what's going on here. How could anybody act like this if they're having any kind of faculties to reason through this on their own without having a strong delusion and believing a lie? But it's because they're not serving God, and that's what was responsible. That's what is behind all of this. They did not love God to seek and serve Him with all their heart. So we can see what that produces. So here in verses 11 and 12, here comes the second captain and his 50. Again, also he sent unto them another captain of 50 with his 50, and he answered and said unto him, O man of God, so there's using the same term, thus hath the king said, come down quickly. And Elijah answered and said unto them, if I be a man of God, let fire come down from heaven and consume thee and thy 50. And the fire of God came down from heaven and consumed him and his 50. Now, was it just by happenstance that God chose a very similar method with the miracle that he showed to bear witness to Elijah before all the nation back in 1 Kings 18 that involved sending fire down from the sky to consume the sacrifice? And now God is sending fire down again to burn up the soldiers. I mean, it's interesting to see the similarity there. And yet Ahaziah is going to send another captain in his 50. I mean, how many times would he have done it if this third captain had been like the other ones? I mean, how many captains would he have sent? How many soldiers would have been burnt up? But finally, there's going to be a man here that's got some wisdom. Before we read about the third one that comes with humility, I mean, here was one finally that put it together. Here's what happened to the two captains and their 50 soldiers that went before them, and here I'm going to do the same thing. What's liable to happen? So here's finally a man that's going to think about it. For nothing else, for preservation of his own life, he's going to humble himself. But he certainly has a wisdom that has not been displayed by Ahaziah or any of these other soldiers up to this point. And so he's going to live as a result of that, and his soldiers also. And of course, Elijah is going to live. He's not going to do any harm to him, and God's going to tell him to go with him. So no harm's going to come to Elijah. God's protecting Elijah in all of this. We're going to pause there before we read about the third one. This event comes up and is referred to in the New Testament in Luke chapter 9. If we can turn over there to Luke chapter 9 for a moment. And at this time, the Lord was sending his disciples to villages and towns to preach his word to the people. And in verses 51 through 56 of Luke 9, it says, it came to pass when the time was come that he should be received up, he steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem and sent messengers before his face. And they went and entered into a village of the Samaritans to make ready for him. And they did not receive him, because his face was as though he would go to Jerusalem. All right, this is the village of the Samaritans. What did the Samaritans think of Jerusalem? I mean, this was the rivalry that was there. I mean, Remember in John chapter 4 when Jesus was at Jacob's well and the Samaritan woman was there. Our father said in this mountain of Samaria is where men ought to worship God. And the Jews say in Jerusalem. So there's this rivalry, Samaria versus Jerusalem. This goes back, its roots to the time of the Old Testament and its history that we're reading about. When the, where was Ahaziah when he fell down through the lattice? That was in his palace. Where? Samaria. That was the capital. That's where Omri, the father of Ahab, had made to be the capital city for the northern kingdom, and it remained so until the end of it, when Hoshea was the last king of the northern kingdom of Israel, and Samaria was besieged and fell to the Assyrians, who then removed the Israelites that remained at that point, took them into captivity, and they were never to be heard from again. But then they sent a collection of people from several different nations and put them into the land of Israel. And so Samaria was their principal place. And those people became known as the Samaritan. It's their descendants that we're reading about here in Luke 9, and the same with that woman in John 4. And so the rivalry between Samaria and Jerusalem, I mean, it has its roots going back to the division of the kingdom, the split in the kingdom in Israel, and then, of course, with the ones who were brought in there by the Assyrians to take over. So not only did you have the rivalry between the two capitals, but now you have these people, these Samaritans versus the Jews that were, and they became known as Jews because of Judah. I mean, that was the predominant number. I mean, there weren't many left of any of the other tribes after that. So there's a natural rivalry there, but that's this is where Jesus is at this point. They find out, well, this guy wants to go to Jerusalem. So do they want to show hospitality to Jesus at this time when he finds out, when they know that he and his disciples are just passing through on their way to Jerusalem? No. So this is showing the rivalry and the enmity that existed between Jews and Samaritans, and it's going to also manifest itself on the other side here with the response when they had that rejection. So verse 54 says, when his disciples James and John saw this, now of all the Lord's disciples, who are the ones that had the softest hearts? I mean, John was the one that's described as the disciple that Jesus loved. If you can find evidence of another one of his disciples that had a more tender and humble heart than John, well, I would like to see the evidence. But, I mean, he was, James and John were among the apostles themselves. I mean, when Jesus would take, I mean, he had the 12, let's say 11, he knew Judas was a devil, but with the among the other 11 that were all righteous, did Jesus, were any of them closer to him and even more special to him than the others among those of the very best? I mean, of the ones on earth at that time, I mean, who were better than the apostles? And then even among them, when Jesus went in the mount to be transfigured, who did he take with him? Peter, James, and John. When Jesus went to Jairus' house, and the leader of the synagogue, the ruler of the synagogue in Capernaum, when he raised his daughter from the dead, which three did he take with him in there? Peter, James, and John. When he went into the Garden of Gethsemane, and they all went with him, but who did he take apart from the others closest to him in his agony on that night? Peter, James, and John. I mean, it's obvious those three were the closest to him. Here's two of the three right here. So we're looking at two of the three, and then of those three, the one that is identified as being the very closest to Jesus, the one that he instructed to be of all ones on earth when he was leaving his mother behind, who did he want to be the one looking after his own mother? John. So here, this is where what James and John said in verse 54. Lord, wilt thou that we command fire to come down from heaven and consume them even as Elijah did? But he turned and rebuked them and said, you know not what manner of spirit you're of, for the Son of Man is not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. And they went to another village. So they're falling to a temptation here to have some very bad thoughts towards these people that were rejecting them. But they were growing and learning too. But I mean, if that could happen to James and John, I mean, which one of us could not be tempted in some way to hate ones that are rejecting the Lord? But we can see the heart of Christ there. But this is in reference to these events here in 2 Kings 1, which again, the fact that these events here in 2 Kings are being brought up in the New Testament, is there any question about the truthfulness of that? I mean, with James and John and then Jesus himself, I mean, that we can see there in Luke chapter 9, this is just another side point to it, the endorsement of the truth of these events. So if this isn't real, then not only is what we're reading here in 2 Kings not to be believed, but then what about anything through James and John and Jesus? So this is why this is all cross-referenced as far as God's witness. He bore witness to these prophets like Elijah. Then he bore witness to the ones, Jesus especially, but also his apostles, James and John and the others. And when they're quoting and referring to events of the Old Testament that they happened, that they were real, God bore witness to them also. So, I mean, how many layers of witness from God to these different ones are supporting all of this and every word that's in here? The strength of it is truly undeniable, which is why he's done that, so we can be without any doubt about the fact that this is every word from God. But yet Ahaziah didn't believe it, and these soldiers didn't believe it when they had the evidence they did, but we don't want to be like them. But the third one is sent out there in verse 13. So back in 2 Kings 1, verse 13, it says, and Ahaziah sent again a captain of the third 50 with his 50. And that's why I wonder in my mind, how many, if this third one had been just like the first two, would there have been a fourth with his 50, and how many? Until he ran out of soldiers and there were no captains or soldiers left. But here's a man that's concerned about his own life and his soldiers. And it says, the third captain of 50 went up and came and fell on his knees before Elijah and besought him and said unto him, O man of God, I pray thee, let my life and the life of these 50 thy servants be precious in thy sight. Behold, there came fire down from heaven and burned up the two captains of the former 50s with their 50s. Therefore, let my life now be precious in thy sight. Is his approach different than the others? The others say, you man of God, come down. The king says, come down and come down quickly. And behind that is the or else. But here, this one is entirely different. He knows what has happened. I mean, God is bearing witness to Elijah in this, isn't he? For fire to come down from the sky and to burn up these men, I mean, God is giving proof that that Elijah is his prophet. So this is part of the witness of God. Not only that, it's part of the witness of God, but also punishing unbelievers. Does God ever do both at the same time? Well, what happened to Elymas the sorcerer in Acts chapter 13, verses 7 through 12, when Paul and Barnabas were on Cyprus and they went and preached the gospel to Sergius Paulus, the deputy on the island, the Roman deputy there, and then that Elymas the sorcerer were contradicting and blaspheming. I mean, here Paul and Barnabas were preaching the gospel, and here was somebody over here contradicting everything that they were saying. And how's this man going to know the difference? You got one person saying or two saying one thing. Here's this other one that's saying exactly the opposite. How's he going to know what's true? Well, God bore witness to Paul and Barnabas, Paul specifically, by striking Elymas blind. So he chose a miracle that at the same time also punished a rebel. So that sometimes happened. And God did that with this in this situation also. Sometimes God did that also with his prophecies, where he would prove a prophet was God's prophet with a prophecy that would end up with the punishment of someone who didn't believe. We got an example of that coming up in chapter 7 here in 2 Kings. We've already seen it with Ahab and things that what happened to him. I mean, there have been lots of examples of it we've already seen. But with Elisha, we're going to see that again, Lord willing, in chapter 7 of 2 Kings, when there was the famine in Samaria, and the king's servant, when Elisha prophesied how the price of flour was going to be, the next day was going to be, instead of being exorbitant as it was in the famine, it was going to be, they were going to be selling grain at a regular price the next day. And then if there would be windows in heaven, shall this thing be, said the king's, that was Jehoram, Ahaziah's brother, who was king then. And then he was punished for that, that he would die and not get to see the benefits of it, which is exactly what happened. But sometimes God would work in that way with miracles and prophecies, where it would reveal who his prophet was and bear witness to them, but also punish those who were not believing. But here with this third captain who humbles himself, verse 15 says, "And the angel of the Lord said unto Elijah, go down with him, be not afraid of him. And he arose and went down with him unto the king." That's kind of interesting. Here it says, "And the angel of the Lord said unto Elijah." So this wasn't God, wasn't the Father speaking directly to Elijah. He used a messenger. Now, which, the angel of the Lord, is this one of his heavenly hosts, the ones that, this means messenger, is what the word means there. Is this what we would consider like a regular angel that God used in many occasions to speak his word, which obviously could be. What's another possibility there? Which angel or messenger did God use with Israel sometime? We know he did throughout their time in the wilderness. And of course, that was Christ, that rock, that was the angel of the Lord's presence. He had used him before. So doesn't say, but it's just kind of interesting, because that's not what we usually read there, where God is using a messenger with a prophet. But that's what it says there. The angel of the Lord said unto Elijah, go down with him. But whether this was the Father speaking directly to a prophet, like what we normally see, or if there is someone that the Father used in between himself and the prophet, whatever heavenly messenger he used, what's the difference as far as what is being transmitted there? Every word is from God. And so he spoke to Elijah and said, go down with him, be not afraid of him. And he arose and went down with him unto the king. So God was protecting his life and told him to go there. And so no destruction on this man and his soldiers. So he humbled himself, and did God reward his humility? We don't know if this man became a servant, of whether he was a believer in God and a servant of the Lord. He referred to himself and his soldiers as servants of Elijah. But to whether he had been a servant of God or whether he was converted to him, we don't know anything more about this man or the soldiers that were with him. This was certainly a grand opportunity for him to become one if he weren't. But in any event, he did humble himself, and God rewarded the humility and spared his life. And so Elijah went with this captain. And so he went to the king. And so in verse 16, he said to him, thus saith the Lord. So now he's going to say to Ahaziah directly to his face what he had spoken to his messengers earlier when he met them on the way to Ekron. Thus saith the Lord, forasmuch as thou hast sent messengers to inquire Baals above the god of Ekron, is it not because there is no god in Israel to inquire of his word? Therefore thou shalt not come down from down off that bed on which thou art gone up, but shall surely die. So God was making it certain, since he didn't even believe in God, to ask God what was going to happen, then God was, the punishment was he was going to die. Verse 17, so he died according to the word of the Lord which Elijah had spoken. So is this more proof that Elijah was a prophet of the Lord? Here it is. I mean, how much proof did God give of that prophet? And Jehoram reigned in his stead. So this is the other son of Ahab. He has 70. But this is the other one that became king. This is going to be the last of the house of Ahab. Jehoram reigned in his stead in the second year of Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat. So that's where it really gets. So remember now, after Jehoshaphat died, his son, he had a son named Jehoram. And Ahab's second son is named Jehoram. And so now they're going to both be there at the same time. But those are the two different Jehorams. But he reigned in the second year of Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, because he had no son. Ahaziah had no son. So it was not going to go. It went to his brother. The succession went to his brother rather than to his son because he didn't have one. Now, verse 18 says, now the rest of the acts of Ahaziah, which he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel? We don't have any more details about him than that, but anything else that would have been recorded anywhere was not good, because he was a very wicked man. But that's the end of him. That's the end of 2 Kings chapter 1. Lord willing, we'll begin in chapter 2 next time, which is where we're going to see, this is going to record the Elijah being caught up in the whirlwind. And he's going to leave this earth, and Elisha is going to be the prophet in his room. So that is to come, Lord willing, in our study next week. We've already had a bit of a preview of chapter 3 when Jehoshaphat's going to join Jehoram to go to a battle. But we will continue our study from 2 Kings, Lord willing, next Lord's Day. But as we close now, or from this hour of study, let's go to our Heavenly Father in prayer again.